Good morning. This is the reading of the Brockton Enterprise for this morning, April 9th, 2026, Thursday. Read to you, this is Mark White of the Talking Information Center. Looking at the headline news today in the Enterprise, the Brockton Police Traffic Unit recorded more than 500 stops in 2 months. In only a few months, the Brockton Police Department is already seeing a return on one of its investments. Brockton announced the police department has made just over 500 traffic stops since its traffic unit returned less than 2 months ago. We're already seeing meaningful progress across Brockton, the city said in a statement. Focused enforcement, community awareness, and a commitment to safety are making a difference on the roads. Of the stops, hundreds resulted in verbal warnings or civil citations. There was also one arrest recorded. These efforts reflect our commitment to safer streets, responsible driving, and a stronger community for everyone, according to the city. A look at the numbers behind each recorded traffic stop since the traffic unit's return is that there were 515 total stops, 430 of which were verbal warnings, 191 citations, 5 of them were courts citations, and 1 arrest. So, also in the news this morning on the Enterprise, the Brockton School CFO departs the district. The school's finance chief, Beth Regalbuto, is leaving after 9 months. Beth Regalbuto is the assistant superintendent of finance for the Brockton Public Schools, and she's leaving the district. That was announced during a school committee meeting on April 7th. Her departure comes as the district prepares to present next year's budget to the school committee and the city council. She started in the role in August, about 9 months ago. She'll no longer be with us, but we do wish her best in whatever comes next. The district will post the position on April 8th, and a district spokesperson didn't immediately respond to questions about her departure. Regalbuto's predecessors left their jobs on bad terms with the districts. The previous administrators Aldo Petrino and Chris Correa were placed on administrative leave in September of 2023. And about a week before, Mayor Robert Sullivan had announced the district was facing a $14.4 million budget deficit for the previous fiscal year. The number later ballooned to $18.5 million. Petrino ceased to be an employee on October 8, 2024, and Correa in December of 2024. They later filed lawsuits against the school's district and the city, where they reached a settlement. Correa reached a settlement while Petronio's case is ongoing. Petronio alleges that the city and the school officials, particularly former Mayor Robert Sullivan, made him take the fall for the deficit. After announcing the end of Regalbuto's employment with the district, Teolani described how the district will manage while searching for her replacement. District leadership is in the midst of building a budget for the next fiscal year, which begins in July of 2026. Because, of course, consistent leadership is essential, we will still be leveraging our partnership with Open Architects, our consultant, who is on the line. Consultant T.J. Plant attended the meeting via video call and answered some school finance questions committee members had. Teoliani also said Sarah Butler was appointed to the position of budget director. Butler previously worked as an accountant for the school district. She was an integral part of our developing our budget for the current year that we're in, and we're excited to leverage her expertise building our budget for the next school year. Before coming to Brockton, Regalbuto was superintendent of the Southern Berkshire Regional School District, which had a budget of around $19 million in fiscal year 2025. Before that, she was the associate superintendent and assistant superintendent of the Hampden-Wilbraham Regional School District for over 10 years, and that district had a roughly $40 million budget in FY25. Brockton Public Schools has a budget more than six times that. So challenges ahead for the Brockton School District. Hanover is to vote on whether to eliminate the Plymouth County government. The Plymouth County government resides in a small brick building not far off Route 3, nestled among roundabouts and fields and other civic offices like the Plymouth Registry of Deeds and the Plymouth District Court. Its nondescript nature is perhaps fitting because many people don't even know it exists. It's a huge problem, said Tom O'Brien, the Plymouth County treasurer, said of people's lack of awareness of their existence. The county, he explained, provides several mundane yet important services that residents would suffer without. But not everyone agrees. In fact, eight Massachusetts counties have been eliminated since 1997, when former Governor Bill Weld dissolved Middlesex County and declared counties obsolete, inward-looking bureaucracies with dozens of departments and department heads that serve themselves and not the taxpayer. Plymouth is just one of six counties in Massachusetts. Barnstable, Bristol, Dukes, Nantucket, Norfolk, and Plymouth that still have a functioning county government. But some are looking to axe it, reigniting a long-held debate over the role and the necessity of county governments. Richard Hughes, a citizen of Hanover, filed a warrant article on March 13th to eliminate or restructure county government in Plymouth County and transfer its responsibilities to the appropriate state or regional agencies. It was certified on March 16th and will be voted at Hanover's town meeting in early May. What does county government do? In most states across the country, counties play a large role in governance. They often handle public parks, build and maintain roads, operate county jails, and have county health departments. But in Massachusetts and other New England states, many of these functions are performed by town and state government. Instead, counties perform a myriad of often dull yet impactful tasks. Plymouth County services include processing parking tickets for 46 municipalities and running the community's 4-H program, providing a group health insurance, and operating a dredge. Many of the services are things the town need, but are too expensive on their own. For example, it makes more sense for the county to lease out the dredge to towns for cheap than for each town to buy their own. O'Brien said the county does a lot of unsexy things behind the scenes. The county also applies for and processes federal grants, something that has become their claim to fame after the COVID-19 pandemic, when Plymouth County was awarded $100 million and $90 million in funding federal relief through the American Rescue Plan, ARPA, and the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. The county government employs a staff of about 10 people, including three county commissioners, county administrator, treasurer, the director of 4-H, and a few assistants, plus an advisory board made up of one representative from each town. Why eliminate Plymouth County government? Hughes, who's also a Hanover Select Board member, filed the warrant as a citizen, first started looking into the necessity of county government after her town was struggling with their growing operating budget. One of our biggest expenses has been on the Plymouth County Retirement Fund. It made her think about what this extra layer of government is really offering to our communities. Hughes said it's not really about the money, after all. The cost of Plymouth County government is only $3.43 per resident per year. Instead, she said she feels like this additional level of government is ineffective and unnecessary. For me, it's whether the functions that are being performed still require this separate county government layer, or if they could be more efficient at the state and the regional level. She said the Registry of Deeds could be taken over by the state, just like county sheriffs have been. A program like parking tickets, she said, hasn't been that helpful in a town like Hanover that doesn't issue a lot of tickets. And while she does think the 4-H program holds a lot of value, she can see that program being taken over by a group of regional schools and local communities. Even the federal COVID-19 funds, she believes, could have been administered at the state level like they were for the rest of Massachusetts. It's really about just streamlining that government and making sure that our county assets are really managed as efficiently as possible. Even though we're only paying, you know, the $1.8 million across our municipalities, this is an extra cost and we're all struggling with our operating budgets. Why are we paying for things if we really aren't seeing the value directly in our own communities? Hugh said she also believes there's some appetite already on Beacon Hill to dissolve the remaining governments. This session, Representative Dennis Gallagher of Bridgewater filed a bill looking into the feasibility of placing registries of deeds that are currently managed by county governments under the oversight of the Secretary of the Commonwealth. That bill was sent to study, which effectively kills the bill on March 19th. Why not eliminate the Plymouth County government? To O'Brien and County Administrator Frank Basler, the Plymouth County administers programs more efficiently and effectively than any other level of government that helps towns money. In the case of the CARES money, they said towns in Plymouth County received almost twice as much as towns in the rest of the state. The town of Hanover, O'Brien said, received about $2.1 million of CARES Act funding, $1 million more than if it had gone through the state. The town used the money for things like masks and vaccines, but also for food for seniors and students, extra Chromebooks for remote learning, plexiglass shields for schools, and additional substitute teachers to cover for increased absences due to illness and quarantine measures. Plymouth County received national awards and recognitions for not turning back a penny. Not a penny, O'Brien said, adding that the state had to repay the federal government due to management mistake. So with all due respect to our friends of the state, we can do our knitting better. We're smaller, we're a little more nimble, we have the skills and the talents and expertise, and we can focus our energies on our 27 communities. This isn't a one-off event either, O'Brien argued. They are constantly looking for other grants that they can apply to. On April 2nd, the Plymouth County announced that they are eligible for over $100,000 in grant funding from the U.S. Department of Justice Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistant Grant Program, which provides funds to help address crime. It's not just the grants they run more efficiently, the county officials argued. O'Brien said while the state believed taking over county sheriffs would save money, that hasn't been the case. The state inspector general found in 2025 the sheriff overran their budgets by over $100 million. They believe they could do even more to save costs if the towns would let them. For example, they'd like to emulate Barnstable County's Coastal Resilience Management Program, which employs three specialists and splits the costs between the Cape communities. You can't afford the $250,000 salary. It's just not as efficient to have those kind of service for all 10, 12 communities that we have along the coast. Hugh said another driver behind filing the Warren articles was because of what she saw as a lack of support, collaboration, and effective communication with the county. Hanover has had issues with the county government in the past, particularly over the management of the ARPA funds. Basler admitted sometimes they miss on the communication front. The officials are encouraging towns who have a problem with county government to come talk to them directly. We're anxious to start the conversation. We'd love to sit down and talk about all this stuff and how we can help the town of Hanover, O'Brien said. Even if the warrant passes, it doesn't mean Plymouth County government will be immediately eliminated. Instead, the town clerk would send a formal letter to the Massachusetts legislature affirming that they would like to consider dissolving Plymouth County. Hughes is hoping to get other towns to submit their own warrant articles to their town meetings, as well as to send a stronger message, but she has seen limited interest so far. Many town warrants are already closed or are closing soon. The Hanover residents will vote on the warrant article during their town meeting on May 4th. All right. In another local story, Lindsay Clancy may admit to killing three kids in what legal experts say. Lindsay Clancy may admit to the act of killing her three young children in 2023 if her trial can be split into two phases, her attorney said. But legal experts say this would not be an admission of criminal responsibility. The 35-year-old Duxbury woman's trial on charges that she strangled her children to death is scheduled to start on July 20th. Clancy has pleaded not guilty. On March 30th, Plymouth Superior Court Judge William Sullivan rejected a defense request to hold a two-phase trial. As Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, requested, prosecutors would first have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Clancy is guilty of three counts of strangulation and murder, and to what degree. Then, they would have to prove that Clancy was not suffering from a mental disease or defect so much as so that she was unable to appreciate the criminality of her conduct or conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. In rejecting the defense's two-phase trial request, Sullivan said that a two-phase trial was unnecessary because many issues presented in each phase would overlap and therefore be redundant. A defendant also does not have a constitutional right to a bifurcated trial. Reddington has asked the judge to reconsider. He said in the April 2nd motion that Clancy is willing to stipulate formally in writing to her involvement in the underlying conduct resulting in the death of her three young children. If that happens, the only live issue at trial would be the defendant's state of mind as it relates to the defense of lack of criminal responsibility, Reddington wrote. But three Massachusetts legal experts who are not connected to the case weighed in on what this would mean. First, there's a difference between guilt and criminal responsibility. If a bifurcated trial were to go forward, Clancy agrees to admit that her actions did kill the children, so she would essentially be accepting a guilty verdict in the first trial phase without contest, said Rebecca Dunley, assistant professor in the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. But she would not admit to criminal responsibility, which would be the topic of the second trial. That's because there's the issue of an insanity defense, also known as a lack of responsibility. The offer to stipulate the underlying facts would establish just part of what's necessary to convict. Crimes like homicide require not only action, but a mental state like intent. What Selma did is only part of the picture, said David Rossman, an emeritus professor of law at BU. Once this lack of responsibility is raised by the defense, it's up to the prosecution to prove that Clancy does not qualify. Specifically, prosecutors will need to prove that Clancy understood right from wrong and had the ability to regulate her behavior at the time of the offense. The burden is always on the prosecution, but Clancy's defense attorney wants to avoid jurors conflating whether she committed the crime behavior, which is pertinent for the first phase, with whether she's legally responsible for it, or what the second phase would focus on. The bifurcated trials are not an unheard-of request, but not a very common request. The prosecution does not have to accept a stipulation. Kevin Reddington, the attorney, is an incredibly experienced and talented and creative lawyer, Dearborn said. He's trying to do the best he can for his client. By seeking a two-phase trial, the defense might also be looking to reduce the amount of potentially inflammatory evidence that will be presented to the jury. You want the jury to fairly assess the issue of criminal responsibility on its own merits, even if the evidence of the conduct is interwoven with that. There's a real risk that a jury will also be shocked and appalled by what happened, that it might influence their ability to be completely impartial on assessing whether the criminal responsibility of the defendant is viable or not. Further, certain evidence that is allowed in one phase might be excluded in another, though the prosecution has stated that their case would be similar for both parts. (Clears throat) Prosecutors have already indicated they are against bifurcation or the two-phase trial, pointing to the same issues that would be in Sullivan's denial order. That is going to be one thorny trial. Also in the local news, he was loved by everyone. The Brockton fire victim, 41, was a school bus driver. A 41-year-old woman who died in an overnight house fire in Brockton has been identified as Jacqueline Leary, a spokesperson for the Department of Fire Service told the Enterprise. Leary, a beloved mother and school bus children for its children with special needs, was killed when a fire tore through her home at 80 Glendale Avenue around 12:30 in the morning Saturday, April 5th. Brockton fire crews fought back heavy flames to reach Leary, who they learned was still inside the burning two-story residence. Once inside, they found Leary already deceased inside a second-floor bedroom, fully engulfed in flames. Two additional occupants, a man in his 70s and a juvenile, escaped the flames and were transported to hospital with less serious injuries. Our hearts are with a family that lost a loved one this morning, Brockton Fire Chief Brian Nardelli said on Saturday. This is a terrible tragedy for them and a sad day for the community. According to the fire department, a preliminary investigation revealed that the fatal fire started in the second floor bedroom where Leary was found. The exact cause remains under investigation, but officials said it does not appear to be suspicious. Leary worked for Pinnacle Transportation Services, where she was a beloved school bus driver for children with special needs. She was loved by everyone, especially the students she transported. She'll be missed by everyone, including the families of the students she cared for, a spokesperson for the transport company said. Lisa Driscoll, who said she is Leary's sister, described her as a loving, caring person who enjoyed nature, animals, and spending time with her family, especially her son. She had a big heart and was always willing to help people in need, Driscoll told the Enterprise. All of our hearts go out to that family. Just quickly looking at some other local stories. These seven Massachusetts farms allow you to pick your own spring flowers. The warm weather of spring may not have fully settled in New England, but the colorful flowers of the season are slowly but surely popping up around the region. Looking to bring the beautiful blooms home? You're in luck. Massachusetts has plenty of pick-your-own flower farms where you can hand-select the perfect spring bouquet. Here are seven places that offer pick-your-own flowers in Massachusetts. There's the Cross Street Flower Farm, a seven-acre, woman-run flower farm that explodes with sustainably grown flowers in the spring, including tulips, daffodils, poppies, buttercups, and peonies. Along with offering beautiful pre-cut flowers, Cross Street Flower Farm hosts various cut-your-own events, including tulips, from late April to early May. $30 tickets, which include 10 tulips, must be reserved for a specific time slot. Cross Street recommends signing up for their newsletter to be notified when the tickets go on sale, and they are located on Jacobs Lane in Norwell. There's also the Cider Hill Farm that hosts Tulip Fest, a multi-weekend festival that celebrates the arrival of spring with 100,000 beautiful blooming tulips ready for picking. The festival offers attractions like hay rides, live music, hard cider tastings, a food truck, family-friendly activities, and a farm store full of snacks and baked goods. Pre-purchase tickets required for the tulip field cost $6 per person for a walkthrough or $24 per dozen for cut-your-own tulips. The tickets typically go on sale on the Thursday before each festival weekend, so be sure to check the website as tickets are expected to sail out. And they are located in Amesbury at 45 Fern Avenue. There's also Woodsberry Farm, a family-owned farm in southern Massachusetts that offers a wide variety of pick-your-own crops, including strawberries, blueberries, peaches, and pumpkins. in addition to flowers. While most crops are available during the summer, Ward offers pick-your-own service for two spring flowers, daffodils in mid-April through early May, and tulips in late April through mid-May. Ward's Berry Farm typically offers mason jars to collect the flowers in, with last year's prices $15 per jar for daffodils and varying for tulips, depending on the field condition. After picking flowers, be sure to check out the farm's other attractions, including a playground, giant bounce pillow, farm animals, hay rides. They are located in Sharon, Massachusetts. And finally, there is the garden at Elm Bank, a 36-acre garden with many beautiful plants, flowers, trees, and walking trails, all maintained by the Massachusetts Horticultural Society. In April and May, the garden hosts Tulip Mania, a colorful spring display of over 75,000 tulips, featuring pick-your-own services. While tickets have not yet been released for Tulip Mania, last year admission cost $21.55 for adults and just under $12 for children. Tickets can be pre-purchased for a specific time slot online, and the Mass Horticulture Society recommends signing up for the newsletter to know when they go on sale. Very quickly, just reading you some of the headlines in the sports section. Brody Bumila makes his second start of the year in Ocean State in baseball. And a former Oliver Ames star named Div 1 college basketball coach. That is with the... she's back in Orange and Black, Laura Gosling. An Easton native was named the 11th head coach in Princeton University. In high school, she was named Massachusetts Gatorade Player of the Year as a senior in 2010. And it's an incredible honor to be named the next head coach of Princeton women's basketball, she said. Also in sports, Marshfield softball is off to a dynamic start at the plate. And also in Norwell, a mother didn't believe it when the Norwell Lax star committed to her college. The Norwell High School lacrosse star Lexi Davis was only 4 weeks old when her mother Jessica, then an assistant at Harvard, wheeled her around practice in a stroller. All along, Davis had a target college in mind. And from the first time she could interact with me, she knew how important Syracuse was to me. She's been surrounded by a lot of orange since she was born. Jessica Davis, a former head coach at Bryant University in Brentley, will now take the reins of her daughter's high school team at Norwell after being on its coaching staff for the last two seasons. Davis takes over on an interim basis for Laura Callahan, who led the Clippers to a Div 4 state championship in her first season and then took the head coaching job at Nobles and Greenough School in Dedham in January. And that, my friends, is a reading of the Brockton Enterprise for today, Thursday, April 9th, 2026. Get ready for the warm, warm weather. It's coming. I think we're done for winter for good. This is Mark White. Now read again next Thursday.